ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate will help you get up to date with what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, this week it's a best of ETF Prime. It's been a while since I've done one of these. I just thought coming off the Memorial Day weekend and given everything that's gone on over the past few months, this was the perfect time to take a breather and revisit some of the conversations I've had this year. And this should be fun. So some of you may have seen this last week. I ran a Twitter poll asking what's been the ETF story of the year so far. And the options I gave were bond ETFs, of course, all the frenzy around bond ETFs trading at discounts back in March, and now the Fed purchasing bond ETFs. That was the first option. The second was American Century launching the first non-transparent ETFs. Of course, those had been, boy, a long time in the making. And then the other two stories were the U.S. Global Jets ETF, which basically went from oblivion to now over, what, $700 million in assets as investors have tried to catch a bottom in airline stocks. And then the fourth story was the United States Oil Fund, ticker USO. Similar to Jets in that investors have tried to play a rebound here, but there are all kinds of other things that have gone on behind the scenes with this ETF and how it's structured. I would say no surprise, USO won the poll fairly handily, about 45% of the vote. Bond ETFs were next with 33%, and then non-transparent ETFs and Jets were 3-4. This week, I'm going to replay conversations around each of these stories. And I want to start with what has been the ETF story of the year so far, the United States Oil Fund. I was joined by ETF.com's Laura Krieger back in April. This was actually one of the most popular shows this year, which I guess makes sense if USO is viewed as the ETF story of the year. But this was fantastic. Laura and I get into all the details of what happened with the USO. We talk about oil futures going negative. And if you enjoy this, I would highly encourage you to listen to the full conversation. This is just a portion here, but take a listen. Laura, honestly, I am not even sure where to begin with this story on USO. I feel like we could easily do a full hour talking about this, and I'm sure something is going to change while we're recording here. Just a wild story.
Right. We just have to talk really fast.
Well, we will do our best here. And you know what? I guess let's do this. Let's maybe start with a few basics, and then we can get into the weeds. Do you want to just explain what USO was originally designed to do? Let's maybe start there first.
Sure. It feels like 800 years ago, talking about ancient history at this point. But so USO, like you said, it's the world's largest oil ETF. And there is this misconception I have found among investors that this means it tracks the spot price of oil. That's not what it does or what it was designed to do. It was originally designed to hold front-month oil futures contracts, which means out of all the futures contracts that are available, those are the ones that are the closest to expiring. It's pretty much the closest you can get to spot without holding spot, which is impossible. That is not happening any longer. We will get to that in a second, I am sure.
And something I think we should talk about a little bit is in owning those futures contracts, obviously the ETF itself is not going to take physical delivery of oil, so they have to roll those contracts, you know, over every month. And I think a basic concept that needs to be covered before we probably go any further is something called contango. And I think some people hear that word, it sounds kind of complex. I think it's actually fairly straightforward. Do you want to explain contango? And I think more importantly, just how it impacts USO or really any ETF holding futures contracts.
Yeah, absolutely. So like you said, USO has a constant position in these near month contracts. And that means every month it's going to need to roll, which means it's going to sell the expiring contract and buy up the next nearest contract. So it's going to roll its position to the next month. So, you know, if the near month is June 2020, it's going to roll into July 2020 and so on. There is a difference in price, usually, between those two contracts and between any contracts along what's called the futures curve. That's the full range of expiration dates. And so when it's more expensive to buy contracts that are farther out, that have expiration dates that are farther out, that condition is called contango. And it basically indicates that traders are expecting that prices are going to go up in the future, right? So contango can be a bit of a challenge if you are trying to maintain a constant position in a set futures contract, because it means every time you have to roll, you're losing money in that transaction. You're having to sell low and buy high, right? That goes not just for oil ETFs, but for like any futures holding contract or futures holding ETF or any commodity ETF that's holding futures. The what makes it extra interesting in oil right now is because contango is super bad in oil right now. And I mean that literally, because we are actually seeing a condition called, and I swear I'm not making this up, super contango. And super contango is just a really massive, massive contango. You're eating 30, 40, 50, sometimes 100% on rolling from one contract to the next. So it's massive.
Yeah, and this is just so important because, as you were alluding to earlier, something like USO is not going to track the spot price of oil, primarily because of this rolling process. And I always like, just at a very basic level, to lay this out by saying, if spot oil prices, let's just say, are flat, you can still lose money in a fund like USO just because it has to roll every month. And to your point, that's the case with any futures based ETF. But before we get into all of the various events around USO, let's briefly talk about the oil market itself and specifically what happened last week. Now, over the past month or so, there had already been a lot of turmoil in the oil market. And I think the short story here is simply that there's just way too much oil sloshing around, right? There's too much supply, not enough demand. Obviously, the economic shutdown associated with the coronavirus has made the situation worse. And I think you also have some geopolitical stuff going on with Saudi Arabia and OPEC playing games with oil supply, Russia. But all of this sort of came to a head last Monday when we saw the May 2020 WTI, West Texas Intermediate Oils futures contract, go negative. And not just slightly negative, but negative by nearly $40. So in other words, you were being paid to take the futures contract. Do you want to try and explain that one?
Yeah. So like you said, it all comes back to oversupply in the market and just crushed demand, right? So, a futures contract is essentially at its heart a promise between a producer of oil and a user of oil to exchange some amount of oil in at a set price in the future. If you're a user of oil right now and you're not actually using any oil, in fact, you can't find any room to store the oil that you already have, well, then you're not going to want to take more oil. You're not going to want to take delivery of more oil. So that's why the contract went negative. As contracts get closer and closer to their expiration dates, producers were literally paying users to take the oil off their hands. Now, this is something I want to make clear before we move forward, because I have gotten so many questions about this over the past few weeks. That May contract that went negative, USO didn't have anything to do with that, right? USO didn't hold any May 2020 contracts at the time that the May 2020 contract went negative. It had already completed its roll period a week prior. It was already entirely into the June 2020 contract. So there were some stories out there that, you know, oh, USO is the one that, you know, the ETF is breaking the market here. That's not what happened. USO was out of May 2020.
No, I'm glad you pointed that out. And actually, that's probably a good segue to talk about everything that has happened with USO, because I think this is where the story does get a little convoluted. And again, I'm not even sure the best way to do this. There's just been so much that's gone on. let me do this. Let me run down several things that happened with the fund recently, and then you can comment wherever you see fit. Does that work?
Sure. Let's go.
So USO has changed its investment strategy. I saw yesterday five times over the past 2 weeks, just in terms of which futures contracts they own, because they were bumping up against the limits set by regulators, in this case, the CFTC, right? There are limits to the amount of futures contracts any one fund can own. And so USO had to adjust what they could hold because the fund was getting too big. And I think another part of this is, you know, they don't want to be in a situation where they're holding all front month contracts that could potentially go negative. Like if the June contracts went negative before USO rolled them over to July, the fund would be on the hook for that. So I think that's the other part. Now, there was also a reverse share split announced that takes place, I believe, at the market close today. USO also suspended creations of new shares last week because they hit the max number they could issue. And so USO started trading in a premium. I'm probably missing something here. I guess I'll just open this up to you to take wherever. Good luck. I told you I was going to let you do all the heavy lifting.
Okay. All right. Let's see if I can cover this quickly and still, you know, talk not like the micro machines guy. You know, I'm gonna try and go as intelligibly as I can. So I think you have to start with understanding why all of this is happening, right? It's not, you know, so with oil prices tanking, that has brought in a lot of new investment cash into USO. We're talking like billions of dollars in a single day, you know, day after day. And that's all from investors thinking that they are going to profit from a future rebound in oil prices whenever, you know, this lockdown situation lifts and we all start revving up our cars and our economy again. So whenever USO gets more money, it's got to buy up the futures contracts to represent that, right? So USO was in the situation where it was getting so much money that they were, like you said, starting to bump up against position limits. So in 2011, the CFTC imposed limits on how much of any one contract any one investor, including ETFs, can own. You can't own more than, I think it's 25% of the deliverable supply of a single contract. And USO had gotten to the point where they had so much money incoming that they were owning 28% of the June 2020 contract. So the next day, they announced a change. We're going to move to an 80-20 portfolio where 80% is in June 2020, that front month, and 20% is in the next nearest month, July 2020. But then they still get more money coming into the fund. So they had to adjust the portfolio breakdown again just a few days later. And then again. So what they did last week was they just said, you know what? We're going to stop specifying a specific portfolio mix. And we're just going to hold whatever contracts we can at any expiration date that we can, as well as maybe some other futures contracts for, you know, other, you know, if need be, other types of petroleum products or derivatives on futures and futures in, of indexes and so on and so forth, just so that we can stay afloat and not bump into these position limits. And we're seeing that they have to adjust their portfolio on a daily basis. I saw today that they've moved into June 2021. That's a year out. They're having to push their portfolio because so much money is coming into this. And like you said, they want to make sure that they're not holding a contract that could potentially go negative, because that would be bad for everybody. So to be fair, they always had the latitude to do something like this. It was in their prospectus to, you know, give them the ability to use derivatives and so on and so forth. But it was kind of a breaking case of emergency sort of situation. And this is them smashing the glass, right? This is essentially USO going from a passively managed front month futures contract or front month futures fund to an actively managed oil strategy ETF. And there are a bunch of them out there right now. And now USO is going to be adding to that mix. So on top of that, you mentioned the creations were suspended, and that was happening because the pace of inflows were such that USO was actually running out of shares from the pool that they had been allotted by the SEC. And so they registered with the SEC to raise their outstanding shares to 4 billion. But as far as I know, the SEC hasn't approved that yet. There's no guarantee that that registration will be approved, or if it will be, that it'll be approved quickly. So I say that because this isn't the first time something like this has happened for USCF, United States Commodities Funds. They're the issuers of USO. Back in 2009, their natural gas ETF, UNG, also had to suspend creations because there was just so much money flowing into it. This was in the wake of the financial crisis. And right around when I think fracking took off and so on and so forth. So it took about 2 months, if I remember correctly, for the SEC to approve new shares. And then another 2 months for the fund to actually reopen to creations. My colleague Sumit Roy, he did a story on this recently. I invite everybody to go check it out. It's a good story. So there's that happening. USO also, you mentioned that there was a reverse split that's going into effect. And a reverse split, basically what that means is that the number of shares on the market is going to be reduced by a set factor, and the price of those shares is going to be increased by the same factor. I think it's a 1-for-8. And so that means that, you know, removed by 8, the number of shares in the market, increase the price by 8. It's not, so anybody who holds USO, it's not going to change the portfolio. It's not going to change your holdings or the total value of your holdings. The only thing that's going to happen is that this adjustment's going to take place. Now, it can impact outstanding orders. If you have any like outstanding limit orders or options, it's going to impact that. And there's something else. Oh, yes. If the number of shares doesn't divide evenly by 8, then anything that doesn't divide will be paid out by cash. So if you have like an extra 5 shares or something, that's going to be paid out to you in cash. That could create a taxable gain, that, you know, taxable event and so on and so forth. So just be aware that there will be implications for a reverse split if that's, you know, if you hold USO.
Okay, so that was everything that happened with USO. They still haven't issued more shares, by the way. And not only that, we found out last week USO is no longer allowed to buy oil futures from the only broker they have an agreement with, which is a whole nother story I'm sure we'll cover in upcoming weeks. But in any event, Laura and I did go on to discuss how Robinhood investors were piling into this thing as it dropped 80% plus. We also talked about ETF education and how really the ETF industry can do a better job explaining the risks involved with products like USO. And of course, on that note, certainly another big ETF story this year is a proposal by several of the largest issuers to better label ETFs. I covered that last week if you missed it. And there's no question the situation surrounding USO was a key catalyst in driving that proposal. All right, the second biggest ETF story in my little Twitter poll was bond ETFs. And I would say on two fronts, the discounts we saw back in March, and then the Fed coming in and purchasing bond ETFs and actually enlisting BlackRock to do so. I'm going to play a portion of two conversations I had. This first one was a real treat for me. Reggie Brown, the ETF godfather, also the recipient of this year's Lifetime Achievement Award from ETF.com. He's principal at GTS, a market-making firm. And he joined me the day after one of the worst days in stock market history. It was also a day where the credit markets really froze up. As a matter of fact, the Wall Street Journal just did a big piece on how that day is going to be remembered forever. But Reggie was tremendous here. I get his thoughts on what happened with bond ETF discounts and whether anything broke. And then after that, I'll play a portion of my conversation with ETF Trends' Dave Nottig, where he talks about the Fed and BlackRock purchasing bond ETFs. And then he offers a 5-minute masterclass, if there is such a thing, on bond ETF and bond mutual fund pricing. It's must listen, in my opinion. So let me start with Reggie Brown, and I begin by asking him how he thought ETFs as a whole held up during the market volatility.
I think equity ETFs, flying colors, has allowed clients to pass risk very efficiently. And I think that over the last 5 years, well, first of all, ETFs have been in the marketplace for 30 years as of March 9th, 1990, first listed in Canada. So we have 30 years of empirical evidence how ETFs behave in all types of markets. And this is just another data point here that the behavior is relatively strong. And so for equity ETFs over the last 5 years, there's been rules and marketplace refinement how ETFs are traded, particularly equity ETFs, how they've been traded, and the rules have been refined to ensure marketplace resiliency and transparency and investor protection. So all that is there. I think what you're seeing, particularly there's a growing narrative around the corporate bond ETFs and then how they're traded, and I think that's just the underlying predictor of just what's happening in the corporate bond market and how that's currently structured. So equities flying colors, corporate bond ETFs, and the market that they follow, there's work to be done by the corporate bond market people, you know, to refine their marketplace.
So I think you raise a good point, because my sense is that most people, even some of the bigger fear mongers, I do feel like they get that stock ETFs aren't a real risk. I think most people can look at stock ETFs and they see how these can add secondary market liquidity. They do act as shock absorbers during market disruptions, which, by the way, is exactly why they were created, right? After the 1987 market crash. But when it comes to the bond side of the equation, this seems to be where there are a lot more concerns, because you hear the term liquidity mismatch, right? That ETFs are advertising intraday liquidity around illiquid assets. And so that could pose a problem. And you look over the past week, especially to your point on the corporate side, we have seen a large number of bond ETFs trading at sometimes pretty sizable discounts. So can you offer some more detail here? I mean, do you view this as a concern? You talked a little bit about bond market structure. What's going on here? I mean, is this an ETF issue or is this a bond market issue?
Well, I think there's a lot of wonky terms out there, but ETFs are only as efficient as the marketplace that they represent or have underlying assets in. And I will also contrast that there's no free lunch in life. So how ETFs behave, also mutual funds also have the same exposure. It just comes down to how they're priced and then what the liquidity surface is inside of the underlying corporate bonds. So I'll offer a couple things just so that to keep it high level. One, the net asset value of an ETF and how it's struck, it's very similar to how a mutual fund determines its fair value. And if they both invest in the same underlying corporate bond, and the fund manager needs to trade that bond as well as ETF market maker, the outcome is very much the same, and you get the same pricing structure. What ETFs allow you to do is to get a real-time view of where corporate bonds are trading, whereas a mutual fund, you don't have that ability. So ETFs come with several benefits. One, you can sell short. Two, you can trade instantaneously. You don't need to wait until a mutual fund strike is NAV. And where the bonds are being struck is where the ETF is forecasting versus it is net asset value. So mutual funds determine their fair value overnight. ETFs determine it in real time. And what you're seeing is that ETFs look like they're trading at a discount, but in reality, ETFs are priced on a bid of the bonds or a midpoint. And when the spreads widen out, and ETFs appear as though they're trading at a premium discount, it's just reflective where the bonds are really trading and where liquidity is happening real time. So the 5 and 6% discounts you're seeing in some of the corporate bond ETFs is just representative of a static NAV, but where the bonds are trading real time at that particular moment that everyone has to trade and have exposure to.
Reggie, I've seen some people out on social media argue that bond mutual funds are better for investors because you will always get execution at NAV. You don't have to worry about those discounts that you're talking about, even if those discounts represent fair value of the underlying bonds. Do you want to comment on that at all?
Well, I think you need to quantify what's NAV. If a corporate bond is trading at 85 cents on a dollar and both the mutual fund manager and the ETF community must trade at the same price, NAV is NAV where the bonds are trading real time. And so it's just a reflection of just the real time. So the argument that mutual funds have, because they're mutualized and offer a safer protection, that's a misnomer. What you're seeing is that, you know, you have to ask an investor, where do you want to be if you're a frequent trader or you want to know how assets are being priced? Where you want to go to, ETF is the go-to source. And I'll give you also a hint. Most mutual fund managers fair value their mutual funds to ETFs. And so that's a real-time predictor that mutual fund managers use. So it really comes down to the structure of the bond market and how bonds are traded. I think that if you contrast between the equity markets and the fixed income marketplace, the fixed income market needs to bring some more innovation in the marketplace, and particularly around a national best bid, best offer where bonds are quoted real time. And then looking at how ETF mutual funds or ETF funds are fair valued, you know, only 20% of the bond universe trades on a given day. So you have a lot of stale pricing. So I think that the evidence empirically will demonstrate that perhaps the pricing of corporate bonds need to be need to find some innovation so that investors have a true price of where the marketplace is being priced real time.
And then quickly here, just to boil everything down, I put Reggie on the spot and I asked him point blank whether he thought ETFs broke during the market crisis. So Reggie, I don't want to put words in your mouth. If we look over the past several weeks, is it your belief ETFs have been functioning properly, or have you seen anything broken?
I would say by and large, nothing broken. The creation and redemption mechanism has worked across the board for nearly every ETF cycle. I think what needs to be looked at is going to be the fixed income marketplace and how bonds are fair valued. There's something called a Security Information Processor, or SIP, that collects information real time and disseminates in the equity markets. You need something very similar to that in a fixed income world in order to give investors a real time view about where corporate bonds are trading. So I think there are solutions out there. I think the fixed income marketplace needs to run a little faster around innovations and look what works well in other parts of the world. But the creation redemption mechanism across the board fundamentally is intact and works well.
Now, you heard Reggie touch on some of the shortcomings in the underlying bond market, that these bonds don't trade often, they're stale pricing, it's not automated. And he explained how, at the end of the day, ETFs are only as efficient as the marketplace they represent. The bottom line is, if everyone is selling, and we should note there were enormous outflows from bond mutual funds, by the way, record outflows. But if nobody wants to own bonds, guess what? Prices go down. It's that simple. And on that note, with all the turmoil in the underlying bond market and with credit freezing up, the Federal Reserve stepped in and they enlisted BlackRock to buy individual bonds and bond ETFs. And this next conversation I have is with ETF Trends' Dave Nodig. And you'll hear him start by answering my question on whether or not there's a conflict with the Fed hiring the largest ETF issuer to buy bond ETFs. But then we also get into how he thinks the Fed should go about buying bonds. And as I mentioned earlier, you've got to hear Dave's explanation on bond mutual fund and ETF pricing and his thoughts on these discounts we saw back in March. Just take a listen.
Look, I get that this totally looks like the fox in the hen house, but I think you have to ask yourself the question, what is the alternative, right? So let's take for granted that it's a good idea that the Fed wants to put a bid on the bottom of the corporate bond market. And I think that is a reasonable thing to do You know, particularly in the liquid space, you know, real questions about what's going to happen when all the triple Bs roll out of liquid space. But, you know, if the Fed is going to do this, how should they do it? What we don't want the Fed to do is to go out and build a bond desk in the middle of all this. That would be a terrible idea because, you know, this is a real expertise. It is a dealer-to-dealer, buyer-to-seller market. So you have to literally know who has what kind of inventory, their systems and risk management processes they need in place. This is not child's play. This is complex financial management. And BlackRock is, I think, inarguably probably the best in the world at it. Now, that are there huge information issues here about, you know, they're going to know what bonds are being bought on one side, yet on the other side, they're running active and passive funds. Sure, you know, will they put the, you know, at least the optics of, you know, the right firewalls in place? Of course they will. So I'm not sure that there was much alternative here. You know, I think we should point out that, you know, BlackRock's also the one that managed the TARP program, right? They've been to this rodeo before and not all that long ago. So, you know, if the Fed's going to do this, it's hard for me to see who else they would have picked to do it. It's not the kind of thing you're going to hand off to a consortium of 20 bond desks and get it. I mean, that would just be chaos. So yeah, optics are bad, but I'm not sure I see a better alternative.
All that said, I mean, do you think this is unfair? And I think about everything that's been written on the big three, especially in the ETF space, right? iShares, Vanguard, and State Street, and how they dominate the ETF business. Do you view this as an unfair advantage for BlackRock?
Well, you know, we don't know right now what the end state of this program is going to look like. They're explicitly prohibited from buying any ETF at a premium. LQD has been trading at a premium ever since this got announced, right? It went from a fairly big discount to a fairly big premium as people piled, you know, last week, in the trailing 6 days, we've seen $6 billion flow into LQD, right? So everybody's trying to front run this buying program. That means they can't buy LQD. And there are actually not very many competitive ETFs. It's not like there's a big laundry list of highly liquid, large liquid bond ETFs out there for them to choose from. You get LQD and then everybody else, and it drops off a cliff in terms of tradability.
One thing that I saw that you mentioned last week was that BlackRock should put a bid on every bond issue that's out there that underlies these major corporate bond indexes. That way you actually get a price to print. Why would that be helpful? Maybe this dovetails into the discussion on bond ETFs.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the reasons we saw this perceived disconnect in the ETF market really had nothing to do with what was going on in the bond market and had everything to do with how bond NAVs are struck. And those are struck usually, I mean, in a lot of ways, but if you're managing it against an index, you're going to take whatever the index provider says that the bonds are worth, because the last thing you want to do is to make your own guess about what an untraded bond is worth. It's very different than, say, Bloomberg's guess on what that is. And now you've created both tracking error and bad pricing. So you're going to naturally just take whatever price is given to you by an index provider. And if it's not being given to you by an index provider, you have your own pricing committee that helps you set that NAV. And the problem is, you know, 80% of the bond market in the corporate space doesn't trade every day. So what do you do with those 80% of bonds? One thing that would help would be to trade all of them, because when it's traded recently, you have a really good sense of what the fair value is, right? If it traded at 3 o'clock, you can be pretty sure you understand what it's worth at 3:15. If it traded in February, you have a much harder time. So if BlackRock came in and literally just bought a one lot, you know, of every corporate issue that's out there, yeah, would it be chaos? Yes, but every one of those bonds would have a real price, and you would see all of the NAVs and all of the prices on ETFs snap right back to the middle.
Okay, so this is perfect. This is a perfect segue into the bond ETF discount story, which I feel like this has been garnering all the headlines over the past several weeks. And just to take a step back, the gist here is we saw a number of bond ETFs that were trading below that net asset value, including some very popular bond ETFs, right? BND, AGG, LQD, which you mentioned. And of course, this in turn brought out the ETF fearmongers in force, right? We started seeing some victory lappers saying ETF somehow broke. I guess I'm just going to hand this over to you to explain, and then we can go from there. You were just explaining, you know, getting a print on bond prices. But for the layman, just walk through what was going on here with these bond ETF discounts.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the cash bond market in the peak of this, you know, over the last 2 weeks, the cash bond market where actual bonds were trading between dealers, institutions, speculators, you know, all the people in the bond market, really the liquidity dried up. And so if you went out there to say, you know, get rid of a $5 million allocation you had to a high yield, you know, Orange County, California muni bond, you literally couldn't get anybody to give you any bid at all. Right. Meaning that you would pick up the phone, you would ask, and this it's effectively how it works. I mean, it mostly happens through Bloomberg messages, but effectively you're picking up the phone, you're calling the guy you know who usually will take your munis off your hand, and you say, hey, what will you give me for this? And he says, I'm not buying. Right. So when you literally have no floor on the price, what does that person do? Well, they immediately say, well, God, I have no liquidity at all. What can I sell? I need to raise cash. I've got margin calls. I'm reallocating. What you sell is what's liquid. What's liquid is the ETFs. So if you had those positions, you dumped them because you couldn't get a bid on the actual bonds themselves. So that means that the price in the market was the price at which point, you know, buyers and sellers and authorized participants were willing to say, okay, look, we have no idea what these bonds are worth right now because nobody's buying. Our best guess is it's about 10% below what you think it is. And that's what prints, right? That's what that trades at. Now, at the end of the day, somebody still has to go through for all those bonds that really didn't trade this time and still come up with a price. And the way most of those things work is they take the last traded price and they adjust it based on what they've seen in the market. And those adjustments are generally very laggy. They take days, if not weeks, to take new information into account because they're trying to run a conservative net model. They don't want NAV to go up and down 10% a day. They want it to be fairly stable because that's historically what bonds look like. In this market, that's not what bonds look like. So you had this old, stale, stable, model-based NAV, and you had very real-world, very responsive, with lots of money behind it pricing on the ETF. That's the disconnect.
So is it your belief that ETFs were operating as price discovery vehicles?
100%. It's 100%. And you can go ETF by ETF and you can show exactly where and why, you know, these things were correct. You know, I did this in the heat of the crisis. I was posting Bloomberg screen after Bloomberg screen on Twitter, you know, and people were saying, why is the, you know, this is so broken. And I'd be like, is it really broken? Look at the last print in this bond that's in there, which was down 20% or something like that. And now you're going to tell me the rest of the portfolio is worth 20% more than that, even though this one bond that did trade printed down 20%. Like, you could prove it over and over again. It's just exhausting. And there's, you know, tens of thousands of corporate issues out there. So chasing each individual one to point out and say, hey, you know what? 12% of this portfolio did trade and it did trade down 10%. So maybe down 10% is the right price for the portfolio.
What about people that would say something like, if you use bond mutual funds, you know you're always going to get executed at NAV. And perhaps that's a more fair model. And I know there was a lot of dissection. Actually, I think you wrote a piece on Vanguard in particular. They present an interesting case study because they offer a share class or an ETF share class of their mutual funds. So you can, right, you can look at both of them, right? But what about people who say, well, look, if you transact in the mutual fund, you know you're always going to get executed at NAV. That's a more fair model.
Well, so that the first part of that sentence is true, right? If you're in a mutual fund, you will get transacted at NAV. It's deeply unfair, right? If you were somebody who was holding BNDs on you know, going into the day when BND traded to a 5% perceived discount, if you sold your mutual fund shares at NAV that day, if you pulled the trigger at 3 o'clock and put in that order and you got that 5% above trading price value for your shares in that Vanguard bond fund, you actually engaged in theft against the people who were still in the fund, because the way you got that excessive price is by, you know, them drawing down a line of credit to give you back your money. And then the next morning, the portfolio manager had to sell something to pay down that line of credit. What do they sell? The most liquid stuff they could. Therefore, BND's portfolio becomes marginally junkier. And guess what? Their act of selling also then printed a bunch of those bonds. So lo and behold, the next day, the NAV comes down. So, you know, you're essentially front running against the people who are being buy and hold investors. You know, conversely, if you happen to think this was a great buying opportunity and at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you put in a buy order, you overpaid by 5%. That doesn't seem fair either.
You know, as you talk through this, anytime we get into the mechanics of ETFs and mutual funds as well, and we start talking about things like NAV and authorized participants and arbitrage, I certainly understand that it's not always immediately intuitive. I do think this can get a bit complex. But at a basic level, we all know ETFs are trading real time during the day. Mutual funds aren't. And so I guess the question I have is, to me, it doesn't seem like rocket science to understand the ETF is going to better reflect reality just because of that, because it is trading during the day. If you understand nothing else, you know that it is. You have people that are putting capital to work. They have a financial incentive, in trading the product to try to get as closely to the fair value as possible. Why do you think this causes so much confusion?
Well, because I think it is non-intuitive. If you're coming to this from a mutual fund world, you've been told over and over again that NAV is fair value, right? So you've learned to accept that. NAV isn't fair value. NAV is a calculation, which in the bond space is based on estimates. And I think that that's really hard for people to grasp. The example that I've been using that I think has given a lot of people an aha moment is, you know, if you go to Zillow and you look up your house and it tells you it's worth $500,000, You shouldn't believe that number in the midst of a housing crisis. But if the guy next to you has to fire sale his house for 50% less than he bought it for last year, your Zillow number is not immediately going to go down by 50%. It's going to take months for Zillow to recognize that your local market has changed. And yeah, your house is probably not worth what you thought it was worth. That's exactly what's going on in the bond market, right? A bond pricing service is nothing more than fancy Zillow.
I honestly think that is the single best analogy I've ever heard on how mutual funds are priced. I absolutely love that. I guess leave it to Dave. It just never ceases to amaze me. And by the way, going back to his comments on the Fed purchasing bond ETFs, he mentioned front running the Fed. That's exactly what we saw. Investors piled into HYG and LQD and some of the other bond ETFs before the Fed even did anything. And I think it's going to be really interesting watching what happens now that the Fed is actually buying bond ETFs, which I've got to tell you, I ran another Twitter poll. Yes, I have a little problem with those. But the poll was on whether the Fed will purchase stock ETFs sometime in the next year. 50% said yes. I'll just leave it at that. Okay, next up is Ed Rosenberg, who's head of ETFs at American Century. They launched the first non-transparent ETFs back at the end of March. The ETFs are the Focus Dynamic Growth ETF, ticker symbol FDG, and the Focus Large Cap Value ETF, ticker FLV. And you'll hear me honestly taking a pretty skeptical approach here, but I thought Ed was excellent. He explains why he thinks the non-transparent structure is important. He talks about the value of active management. Of course, he offers his opinion on what these should be called. There's been a lot of discussion around that. But we pick up the conversation with him literally explaining why they don't want to disclose their holdings, why they need to hide their intellectual property. Take a listen.
There are certain securities that you may own that you can't trade in and out of in a single day. So somebody can front run that. And I'll give you an example. At one of my previous locations, and it was an index fund, where it was proprietary, we used to publish the index changes prior to them actually going out. And the portfolio managers noticed some strange behavior with some of those securities. And once they stopped publishing the holdings, they noticed that strange behavior stopped. And they realized that they were taking a hit of anywhere about 50 basis points each quarter every time they published it, to somebody front-running the actual changes to an index. Now, this is just an index. This isn't even active. And once they stopped, there were trading firms that actually called, and these were small shops, not the big ones, asking to buy the data because they were obviously making money, and there wasn't a price we could charge, one, that would be good for the investors, quite frankly, because they're hurting the performance, and two, they were willing to pay a lot to get that data because they were making money. So front running does happen. It happens with index changes. We don't talk about it. You know, the Russell rebalance is a big one where if those weren't published in advance, you'd probably see different performance out of those securities. But if you own, as we said, let's call it 30 to 50 names for all between the two portfolios, if I have a large position in something and can't trade out of it in a single day, someone can see that if I'm publishing the holdings every day. And quite frankly, if they can see it, they can get ahead of it. The other thing they can do, Nate, is they can free ride. They could just rebuild the portfolio because it's not that big. And so 30 names, we could be giving away the quote-unquote IP to anybody if we publish the names. And that's also a fear. We think we have a good methodology. And if you look at the performance since we've launched, it's been very strong. We don't want to give that away.
Okay, so I think your first point, that's really interesting, and you do hear that out there quite a bit with index rebalances, that you'll have the high-frequency traders and other algos out there trying to front-run those trades. To your second point, I guess, what about just the overall challenges of active management? So I know you've seen the performance figures out there, right?
Yep.
They haven't been great. And I know there's some nuance to the numbers. I get that. But if I can paint with a broad brush, I think we would both agree active management has been challenged, at least over the past, 10 to 12 years. And so,
absolutely.
And so to your second point, I think the quip that you'll hear with semi-transparent ETFs is, well, active managers are flattering themselves if they think people want to copy these strategies, right? Nobody's sitting around trying to replicate these. So what's your response to that?
Well, let's take a different approach on that, right? The structure itself in ETF is a very neat, novel concept that's still only been around for like 27 years, right? And so just because you put a bad mutual fund into a new novel structure does not make it a good investment vehicle. Let's start there. So the structure itself does not make it this all of a sudden all saving grace. Now, what it can do is make a bad manager look a little better, but what it really can do is make a good manager look even better. And so if you notice, we were very particular about what we launched in this structure. We wanted to put our best foot forward, and when you put your best foot forward, you're putting your best thought process and your best idea and potentially your best IP. Now, I want to say best IP with a caveat. We can only invest in U.S. securities, so we couldn't do our best idea in international, for example.
Well, and hopefully that'll change.
Hopefully. But the idea here is to put your best foot forward and your best thought. So even if you look at the funds, Focused Dynamic Growth, and Focused Large Value does have an SMA that if somebody was curious, they could see the performance of it. If they really wanted to, we could find it. But in reality, they both have done very well over the last few years since they've been out, and it's what we're targeting. We want to put our best foot forward. And here's the other thing. If we look at the last 12 years, Nate, I mean, if you weren't fully invested, you were probably trailing the index. And a lot of active funds carry cash, the mutual funds themselves, specifically because they have to meet redemptions of what's coming in and coming out. The one advantage to the ETF structure is you don't need as much cash. So instead of carrying 3% cash, maybe you carry 1% as a tactical to invest in when markets dip like they are today. And so you can also eliminate some of that cash drag. But in volatile markets, active management is something I would want. I mean, if you look at sectors like consumer discretion, right? Would you want to own that whole sector? Or would you really want to own the best stocks like Amazon, which is still positive for the year when most of the sector is negative?
Okay, and then I jump ahead in the conversation here. This is Ed discussing whether investors even care about the daily transparency offered by traditional ETFs. And this starts with me reading a quote Ed had to CNBC. You said, quote, "I was checking with some of the main websites that publish the holdings of every ETF and asked them what percentage of people that visit the site actually look at the holdings. And it's way lower than I anticipated. They said it was only 15%. So if you eliminate the people that really look for holdings, this is just an ETF to everyone else." So I guess to what you were saying, to me, it sounds like you think the daily transparency of holdings is overrated. Is that a fair assessment?
I do. So I'm going to use Focused Dynamic Growth as the example why, right? So our start date was 3/31, right? We publish the top 10 holdings every month, 10 days after month end. The top 10 holdings make up somewhere of around 45 to 50% of the fund. So you can easily see that. The holdings actually were published on 4/15, so anyone can see them if they wanted to. And quite frankly, even on our own site, almost no one's looked at the holdings yet. So no one's actually digging into the holdings. What they're digging into is the philosophy and the strategy and seeing how it fits. And I think you see that. This is just an example of this ETF, but I think you see that with more and more ETFs as we go through. I think the transparency, it's great because it actually can help some people make a decision, but it's not the majority of people. And I think what you're getting to is people really want to understand the manager's philosophy. And quite frankly, if it's not a basic index, everyone I've talked to really digs into the methodology of, let's say, an alternatively weighted ETF, mm-hmm. some rules-based process. They don't look at the holdings. They want to know how you get to the holdings more than what the holdings are. And I think that's the most important aspect. What is the manager doing, whether it's an alternatively weighted or it's active? How do you get to those holdings? And that, to me, seems to be the more important aspect. So I don't think that transparency is as important as everyone has made it out to be.
Well, and I think along with that, I'll hear, if you're a long-term investor, should you really be looking at every single holding every single day? Obviously, you should understand the strategy. You should understand whatever the index is you're tracking. If it's an index-based product, understand the manager's objective if it's actively managed. But, you know, otherwise, if you're a long-term investor, does it really matter? Again, if you can crawl in and see the holdings every day. I think, to your point, there's some debate on that. Ed, just a minute left. Before I let you go, I have to get to the question that I know everyone wants answered. So I've been calling your ETFs semi-transparent throughout our discussion, because I know that's how American Century refers to them. But if I'm being honest, I've lazily referred to these just as non-transparent ETFs. I think just because that's what they were called from the very beginning. Now, I think Bloomberg is calling these ANTS, which stands for active non-transparent. I've seen CFRA and ETF.com say these should just be called active equity ETFs. Ben Johnson over at Morningstar says active non-transparent. I'm going to put this to you. What should these be called?
I mean, to give my honest answer here, right, I think they should just be called ETFs in general, because that's what they are. But if you really have to go with a label and go beyond that, semi-transparent to me makes the most sense. And the reason is because there's data out there. As I mentioned, the top 10 holdings are out there every month. There is an INAV out there, which is called the VIIV. Instead of being published every 15 seconds, it's published every second, and anyone can look it up. So they know the value of the securities in the portfolio every second. So there is some transparency, not necessarily to the holdings, but the valuations. And that's why I think if you really wanted to dig into a label beyond ETF, it should be semi-transparent.
For the record, I am sticking with non-transparent ETFs for the time being. I guess I'm just a creature of habit. Maybe I'll change that at some point. But in any event, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens with these ETFs. If you look at the two American Century ETFs, they really haven't lit the world on fire in terms of assets so far. It's been pretty slow going. And along with that, we haven't seen any new launches from other fund companies yet. But I will say it is still early. I think everyone knows I'm skeptical, so we'll just see what happens here. And regardless, I did really enjoy that conversation with Ed, and I definitely recommend listening to the entire interview if you missed it. Okay, last, we have to talk JETS, the U.S. Global JETS ETF. I was joined by the CEO of U.S. Global, Frank Holmes, and this starts with him giving some background on where he came up with the idea for the ETF, and then we get it all into the investment case behind airlines. Take a listen, and then I'll pop back in just a few minutes. So, Frank, so many questions I have. You know, it's remarkable. Assets in JETS went from around $35 million at the beginning of March to about $600 million now. That's 2 months. And I saw a Bloomberg note that this ETF has taken in money now for 49 straight days. Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas pointed that out. I guess first, let's set the table, and then I do want to come back to these flows. For investors who aren't familiar with JETS, just take us through the basics in terms of what it holds, how the holdings are weighted, anything else you see noteworthy.
Sure. Just to help everyone understand the concept was that I noticed that we're called U.S. Global Investors, and my options in flying had dropped by 30%, and the cost of my tickets went up 300%. So I got a little frustrated, and I said, I've got to also get into the ETF industry and launch some products. So I went out and did research and tried to recoup all my travel costs. I launched JETS ETF. And, you know, it went sideways for 5 years. We quickly got it up to 100, then it was down to 50 and back up. But it went sideways. 3 years ago, Buffett came in and started buying the airlines again. When I first launched it, he didn't like the airlines. And he changed, and I said he would change because the airline industry has the capacity to generate huge cash flow returns on invested capital when this economy is chugging along. And so that was sort of the creation of it, the concept. And the other part was creating a what they call a smart beta 2. That is, we did a lot of data mining, and we spent thousands of hours. And what we created was that we've noticed is that Southwest Airlines, Delta, United, and American Airlines have the survivors of all these mergers during the bankruptcy years, which started 15 years ago. And as it came out of this bankruptcy and after 2008-9, you saw a change. And you, all of a sudden you saw prices of tickets going up, options to fly drop, and they would start charging these ancillary fees. So we noticed that those four big titans basically are 80% of the travel in America. And so we create the ETF that four names are 12% each, and they rebalance each quarter because there's a real different set of competition factors between them, and they all have unique models. But we did note that they have a moat around their business. And so with that, we then said, how do we create other airlines and deal with global volatility? So we basically, like a pro sports, used our benchmark was a New York Stock Exchange Global Airline Index, and said, what factors do we need and what allocation do we need that could beat it on a consistent basis, like 80% of the time? And after thousands of hours of backtesting and figuring it out, we launched it, and that's what it's done. So it has 20 names at 1% each, which are foreign. It has a total of 33 names. Four are 48%. So it's an interesting concept that 80% of the holdings are U.S. holdings, but 70% of the names are foreign. And that really helped mitigate currency volatility over looking back over 12 years of data.
Okay, Frank, so in terms of what's been going on in the airline industry, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, right? We've had a global economic shutdown because of the coronavirus. I've seen air traffic has plummeted, 90, 95%. Airlines are really just burning cash right now. And then also, you mentioned Warren Buffett a little over a week ago, a story that made a lot of headlines. We learned that Berkshire Hathaway had divested their entire position in the big airline stocks. And so from the outside looking in, this doesn't look great, right? I think we would all agree it's going to be a while before airlines return to the level they were operating at previously. However, I did see that you recently said this could be a once-in-a-generation buying opportunity. So the question I have for you is, why is that? Walk us through the overall investment case here for airlines.
So it's a jump ball, and is it going to be a V-shaped recovery or a U-shape? The bears say it's an L or a Nike swoosh, but I think it's going to be much more of a U-shaped recovery. And so what has happened in previous cycles? So if you go back to tech bubble, September 9/11 crisis, which the airlines actually all shut down. You had SARS in Asia, what happened? And you had the 2008-9 crisis. What's fundamentally different, and what's been learned, basically the regulatory bodies and politicians have learned, you have to support the airline industry to turn the economy around. One in 15 jobs are airlines related. So this is unprecedented support with the CARES Act for this industry. And in fact, today the Feds are coming in and the Federal Reserve and buying ETFs in corporate bonds because corporate bond yields have gotten way, way above what the 10-year government bond is. And so they have to create liquidity into the system. So I think there's unprecedented support that lends it that we're not going to get this L-shaped type of recovery. And so what happens in previous cycles is that they fall 50 to 60, actually 70%, these stocks, the airline industry, and then they rebound between 80 and 150% over 8 to 15 months. So there's a huge bet in this particular industry that, A, you've got government support and sponsorship, that this industry has the potential to double over the next 12 months. And I think that that's the big interest, and it's the only ETF that really covers and focuses on the airline industry. Now, as for Buffett, we must remember this incredible maven, this incredible brilliant mind, he is 90 years old this year, and he is totally risk averse. And you're seeing that he's not making investments, and he's actually been piling cash. And the thought process from bankers is that he's going to just take out Southwest Airlines when it turns, or one of the domestic airlines, because he's talked about it a couple years back. And so I think that he's got his powder dry. He's very, very cautious, wants to see how the economy as a whole. Whereas in 2008, he was much faster jumping back into the market. After 9/11, he was much faster jumping back into the market. He's not in this period.
And quickly here, one of the reasons this ETF has been such a big story is because investors are piling into it, even though we all know what's been going on with the airlines. So here I asked Frank about that, whether he's surprised at all by the flows. We have now seen, what, over $650 million into jets this year. I guess, are you surprised by that? And what does it say to you that investors are looking to this ETF to play a rebound in the airline industry?
Well, I think it's a great statement. People can't wait to fly. It's always, I think there's a pent-up demand to be able to fly. But I think that what Eric was telling me that, the average ETF that doesn't grow through 100 million only lasts 3 years. And we waited 5 years for this. So we're very patient, and we have a low cost structure to be able to survive through that long drought because it was the only product. And it's like Hack. You know, Hack took off when Sony got hacked.
Yeah, I mentioned that earlier, yeah.
And so the same thing is here. It's the first time, though, that something has fallen, but it's attracted deep value investors. It's attracted traders. It's attracted those that believe that you have to have the airlines if you want to bet on the economy. It'll be the first mover advantage will be the airline industry.
I mentioned this when Frank was on the podcast. I love seeing ETF stories like this. You know, Frank and U.S. Global, they stuck with this ETF. They hung in there, and now it's paying off. I saw Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas. He noted that jets has had 57 straight days of inflows. Think about that. It's now close to $750 million in assets after being around $35 million at the beginning of March. Great story. And I think truly remarkable given the context, because this isn't some high-flying industry right now. It's an airline industry where we don't know how long it's going to be for things to get back to normal. So just a great story with jets. All right. Hope you enjoyed this Best of ETF Prime. Really appreciate everyone listening. And I've got to tell you, I'm really enjoying hearing from everyone right now. I'm receiving a lot more emails from listeners. I love the interaction. So please keep sending me the feedback. Next week, two excellent guests for you. I'll be joined by the aforementioned Eric Balchunas. We're going to do what I'm going to call an ETF world tour. We're going to cover as much as we can in the time we have. And then David Mann, head of ETFs at Franklin Templeton, will give us the latest on how the Fed's bond ETF purchases are going so far. Until then, have a great week, everyone.